This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Piotr Kruszycki. I'm a professor at the University of Maryland in College Park. I'm very proud to host today Professor Yunus Blavaskunas, who is joining me from Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's wonderful to have you here. Professor Blavaskunas is the author of Foresters, Borders, and Bark Beetles, The Future of Europe's Last Primeval Forest, which was published in 2020 by Indiana University Press. Just a few words about Professor Blavaskunas. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Environmental Studies at Whitman College in Walla Walla. She has held numerous prestigious fellowships, including a Rachel Carson Center Fellowship, a Fulbright Fellowship, and a Switzer Environmental Leader Fellowship. She researches the politics of nature conservation and forestry and has a keen interest in rewilding phenomena both in Europe and in the U.S. Can I ask you, just to start off, can you say a little bit more about what rewilding is for those in our audience who aren't that familiar with nature conservation or ecology?
Sure. Rewilding is the idea that you let go of certain domestic ideals about what a landscape could be. So it takes many forms, but across Europe, it's about de-domesticating animals and moving them around in the landscape. And in the U.S., it seems to be a lot about moving large predators around, taking degraded ecosystems and restoring them, but with sets of ecological relationships that are a bit predetermined.
This idea of degraded ecosystems being restored obviously gets us in some sense also to one of the key themes of your book. I have to say first off that this book read like a trade book. It was a very good read, and it was a very quick read in a good sense, where I felt like I really got into all the stories you were telling, and I feel like I could easily assign the whole thing to the right undergrad class if there were a lot of interest in it. So my compliments, because it was fun to read. I wanted to ask, is this the kind of book that basically needed to be prepared over the course of many years? Or is it the type of book that could be written with a kind of bird's eye view packed in more briefly with this sort of more focused, you know, is rewilding and thinking about it in Poland something that you could have done in a couple years, or it needed a lot of time to percolate?
Oh, I think it needed a lot of time to percolate, not only because I had been going to Poland for so many years or other projects kind of derailed the writing, but I think the story is much richer if we think about this story as a transition, if we think about it as a period of post-socialism, which unfolded both in the forest and in the composition of the forest, but also what happens politically, what happens socially with people. I mean, one of the most interesting things for me was what happens to people who are classified by the communist government as worker peasants. When you have the rise of ecotourism in a totally different way than you had in the communist era, who's moving to this area? How do people who have lived in this area for a few decades or even hundreds and hundreds of years, how are they sort of redefining themselves along the lines of, what is capitalism? What are the aspirations for the future? How should this forest be used and protected and visited by tourists? So I'm really happy for any sort of delays that got in my way in terms of writing this book, because I kept finding ways to go back and do a little more research. And, oh, then this was happening and this was happening. And I can't stop the writing of this book now. So I feel like, yeah, it did need that amount of time. And of course, any book can be written in a short window, but you get a different type of perspective when you do that.
Well, as a historian, obviously, I would also say that the accumulation of material, what you just described, at a certain point, we try to maybe artificially put a lid on it and say, that's it. But when you're living the material as an ethnographer, obviously, I'm not an ethnographer, but one of the virtues of this book is I feel like I'm living the material with you when I'm reading through it. There are individuals in your book, your protagonist, who died. So in some sense, you have an organic bookend, so to speak, there for their stories, right? But for the political side, and obviously post-socialism is a living, breathing phenomenon. Goodness knows, I mean, we're recording this for those in the audience the day after massive protests about whether or not Poland is going to exit the European Union. And the European Union is also a big part of your story. But maybe I should just step back for a second and say that, look, thinking about capitalism and post-socialism in Poland through the lens of Białowieża is not something that had occurred to me before. There was, you know, Żubrówka at my wedding, and I love Hajnówka. I have family who live not too far from there, but I had never thought about Białowieża as this kind of extraordinary microcosm for exploring the different disciplinary and really humanistic perspectives on the region. So what led you to look for capitalism and post-socialism in the primeval forest?
Oh, well, you know, I think when you read the book, you realize I don't go there looking for one thing or the other. It's kind of a series of accidents. But also, I mean, along the way, I'm also always in conversation with environmental historians. And at the core of environmental history is this idea that the natural world or forests or rocks or whatever it is play a role in history and its unfolding. So in many ways, you know, I haven't been trained as an environmental historian, but I've been in conversation with environmental historians for a long time. They've been part of the way I think. So it almost seems intuitive to me at some point, you know, as I develop as a scholar, that this is really the only way to tell that transition is to tell it in relation to what is the composition of tree species, of bark beetle, of dead woody debris on the forest floor, and how does that inflect upon what people imagine as being communistic or capitalist or capitalistic?
I mean, I think that's absolutely fascinating. Obviously, this is born also of your own direct experience. Your first contact with Białowieża was in the mid-1990s. This may be kind of a silly impressionistic question, but what would you say the biggest changes were that took place while over the years that you've been going back?
Oh, well, changes with humans and the non-human world is that I remember seeing people, especially young kids, running barefoot, taking cows back from the meadow, and seeing whole families scything hay at the boundary of the forest. And now with the loss of agriculture in the forest meadows, which was never that productive. I mean, as I talked to people, I learned it's really hard to farm when the boar try to come and eat your vegetables and the deer and everything else. But what's happened is that bison, these woodland bison, have come out of the forest into the meadow now that people by and large have stopped farming. So that's occurred. But I also saw the loss of a number of very old trees in the forest. You know, you could see this on the Schaffe Reserve as you're driving into Białowieża. Certainly humans and ecosystems together are very dynamic. You know, I saw sort of wars over dead woody debris on the forest floor. And for people who haven't read the book, I mean, dead trees toppled over on the forest floor can provide a lot of nutrients to the ecosystem. They can provide areas for lynx to run over, small mammals to go under. They retain a lot of moisture in the landscape in a climate that's drying out. So, as the Capitalocene extends, we also see climate change extending, and that means hotter, drier summers. And I know people, if they're listening in Europe, totally know what I mean. And so means the spruce are toppling over. Spruce, which were heavily planted in the 20th century. What does that mean? Is this forest, I mean, this forest also has many oaks, 500-year-old oaks, lindens, hornbeams. Is it a deciduous forest? Is it a forest with pines and spruce? What sort of compositions should there be? I mean, these very kind of ecological and management questions are at the core of how people have been identifying what they are fighting over in this forest. And those are fights about politics. So, those are the kinds of changes I've seen over the last 25, now, gosh, more years.
This reminds me of the category you mentioned a few minutes ago, the worker peasants, because there are a lot of different social groups in play. Actually, there's far more in play, at some local, some imported, some obviously there's a lot of touristry. But the idea of, let's say, maintaining worker peasants and also maintaining gentry, even if it's more in terms of cultural legacies and everyday practices. Once the communist system collapsed, there's if you know the study by Longina Jakubowska, Patrons of History,
yeah.
It's something that's helped me in my own work, which she basically focuses on Polish gentry through a series of political orders and looks, for example, at how the construction of the communist order benefited from appropriating certain practices and certain cultural norms of the gentry. Is there really class warfare in Białowieża?
Ooh, wow. That sounds like a historical argument.
Intentionally provocative. And of course, I mean, to be fair, we could distinguish different time periods here, because it would be strange to say that there's class warfare before 1989, but maybe that's another change you've seen. Curious what you think.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to acknowledge another scholar who's helped me think about that, and that's Tomasz Zarycki, who wrote Totem Intelligentsia and a number of books about and articles about the legacy of the aristocracy. Does the aristocracy die when communism is put in place or not? Or how do the new communist apparatchiks appropriate the customs and manners of the aristocracy? Class warfare is also a Marxist term, and you know, you think then, whose term should I use to apply what's happening in the present moment? I mean, there are certainly class antagonisms going on. Okay. And but one of the, you know, interesting ideals of the capitalist moment is that, oh, that doesn't really exist. Everybody's just kind of an independent agent. And if you're smart, you can pull yourself up from the bootstraps and become an entrepreneur. But I mean, Białowieża is infused with classism right now. And this is through a sort of visiting elite that can afford some very expensive restaurants that are there, hotel options for people who haven't been there, who haven't read the book. I mean, Białowieża went from being, first a royal hunting ground, Polish kings and then Russian czars, to this real kind of backwards outpost. I mean, the interwar period is still Polish presidents hunting there. But in the communist period, it seems to be neglected or forgotten somehow. There are naturalists that visit, but only people who go there because they really love birds and mosquitoes and forest ecosystems. And then by the mid-2000s, wow, do we ever see the return of elegance to this place? And, you know, many local people become wealthier than they were. I would not call them wealthy, but people went from not owning a car and to, you know, using bed and breakfast money and businesses and loans to take a vacation in Italy or Egypt. And I think that felt really good to people. I think they were really proud of that ability to increase their social status. But then there were also many people in the book who don't benefit from that at all and don't quite have the social skills. I would say there are ongoing class antagonisms, but the classes are not identical to what they were a sort of pre-communism or during the communist period. We're seeing new classes of people.
Let me maybe ask about two specific individuals, because they're among the folks you highlight in your book. I'm thinking of Simona Kossak, of course, and Leszek, the man of the forest. The Kossak name is a name that obviously I think many folks who know contemporary Poland would have encountered through the Panorama Racowicka, through the family of painters, right? But this is a major figure, a towering figure, and in some sense, a really unique and almost mythologized figure. The lynx sleeping in the bed and the complete lack of any technological entanglements. Can you say a few words, just introduce for those who haven't seen your book yet, this powerful scientific figure?
You know, it's very funny the way I come to know Simona. So I'm working at the U.S. Forest Service in Washington State, and these Polish foresters come to visit us, and they tell us about the Białowieża Forest. But then through somebody who works at the World Bank, I get Simona's name and phone number. And I set off to Poland in 1995 because I want to see what this kind of post-revolutionary world is all about. I'm in my early 20s, and I'm in Wrocław, staying with somebody's mother, just a weird connection. And we visit the Panorama in Wrocław. But I don't immediately associate this woman I'm about to meet with this painter. Forgive me if that's Wojciech or...
Wojciech, yeah.
Wojciech who painted that, yes. So like I go to Białowieża in 1995, somebody picks me up from the train station in Białystok, and the first place I'm taken is to Simona Kossak's cottage. And, you know, I really am totally clueless, which in some ways is part of the mysticism that I unfold in the story. Like Simona is somebody I admire and I'm totally intrigued by. And she has this sensibility and this way about her, which is very commanding, but also intriguing. You know, she wants to take me to the intrigue of the forest. And within the first few days of being in Białowieża, we go to this miejsce mocy, this place of power, which is, you know, totally undeveloped. If you go there today, there's a tourist sign pointing you there. And she's trying to explain this place to me vis-a-vis the configuration of trees growing in pairs out of one trunk. And there's, I don't totally get it, but there's some stones in the ground. And she's using her very limited English to say something like Stonehenge. I get that there's been dowsing there. There's some kind of energy. So the story as it goes is that, you know, I have a relationship that starts with Simone as a very central figure and somebody who I think is going to lead me places. But then it's also one of a great deal of tension. The more number of years that I go there, Simone has this animal rights stance. And I am at first sort of under her tutelage for a year during my master's thesis. But then I decide I want to expand and work with other scientists who are there, who she has these real antagonisms with. And then I start, you know, listening to all the gossip about Simone and who she is and what she did. And it was a very difficult chapter to write because in so many ways, I still really admire this person. But the line of the story is that in some ways, she's perceived as facilitating a kind of communist cronyism that she seems to be so against.
I mean, in that sense, she's part of this story of the gentry that got appropriated into the communist ethos or even instrumentalized somewhat. I don't want to be uncharitable, but I'm just curious because that is the implication I get from your chapter about her.
Yeah, and like the more I think about her and the story, that's the way the chapter gets written.
Okay.
And that's, man, that's complex. And that's what the political tensions of the last 10 years at least have been about.
Right.
Like who was a communist? Did the heroes of solidarity collaborate with the communist government? And then, you know, it flips in a few chapters later to, who is Levatstvo? Who are these pinkos, environmentalists? So I trace these tensions between who was a communist? Who is gentry? What does it mean to be international in this moment? Those ideas all move across the book.
Yeah. Well, class antagonisms, I think, are very much, and of course, they don't have to mean the same thing at different contingent moments. They wouldn't. But I'm struck, you know, just the juxtaposition, if I think of Kossak on the one hand and Leszek Szumowicz on the other, because Leszek Szumowski on the other, he becomes this figure for you in terms of the post-peasant. I don't know if you would necessarily describe him as a worker peasant, for those who haven't read the book, the phrase that I think that I found most striking for Leszek, and you talk about him by his first name all the time, is man of the forest. That in some sense, you know, the surname doesn't matter because he transcends these kind of traditional nomenclature, and on the one hand, I'm very sensitive to the idea of the gentry and its entanglements in the communist era and also in the people who work the land. But how does he figure for you? Is he a one-off or can he be generalized, if you will, within this sort of matrix that you've been thinking about and ruminating on in class terms or otherwise?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Leszek is certainly unique. I didn't meet anyone else like him, but I wanted to use him in the book to talk about the ideals that people have for this place. The ideals that you could come to a primeval forest and find a sort of primitive man of the forest. But he totally comes from this peasant root, from the worker root. I mean, his dad was a logger. You know, his mother was a Belarusian peasant. But he's only able to be this figure, the man of the forest, because he's networked himself with a lot of important people, with filmmakers, with Adam Weirach, who's this famous environmentalist in the old Vieja, with myself. He talks about knowing Lech Wałęsa, the director of the Warsaw Zoo. I mean, he's constantly showing me how connected he is, but always wanting to let us know that he's something exceptional. But if you look at what the gentry, I I don't know if I can still use this word, but the nouveau riche, the people with money who are visiting this area, they come in with wanting to replay fantasies about who is gentry and who is peasant. And, you know, the story I tell through Leszek is one both of Polish peasantry, but also one of local people who are from this place who were never true peasants. And that's a very interesting category, that they've always been given some sort of royal right to settle, that they were the king's beaters, that they helped with the hunt, that they were noble in some way. So then if we think about who is gentry, who is peasant, who is petty gentry, you know, we can't let go of that historical figure in all of this. I think Leszek is unique. He's one-off, but he's also very generative of the meaning of these social relationships. And that's what I so love about being the ethnographer, is that you get to know people in these intimate ways, some of whom tell you to get out of here and others who sort of invite you into their world, but you begin to understand the tensions within a society through certain people who befriend you. And I have to say that Leszek was a real friend of mine, and that's very endearing in a different way that Simona was not. And I still admire Simona, but there are figures in this book that help me see those gentry peasant historical relationships, and Leszek was a good one for that.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Your casting, especially of Leszek, reminds me that when I was reading your book, on many occasions I was thinking about Pan Tadeusz. Not just because of Soplicowo, right? The faux recast hotel for wealthy visitors and folks who want to take those very carefully managed and curated trips into the Belarusian side, but also because Leszek, for me, recalls the Mała Szlachta to a T. That's partly actually why I asked the question about post-peasant identity, because in some sense, by being attached to the post-peasant identity, but in this cosmopolitan way you were describing a minute ago, he really inscribes himself for me into a very early 19th century kind of trope, literary, social, right? The folks leftover, if you will, the leftover identity, but in some sense also the shared border with Belarus and the transition from Soviet Belarus to transition such as it was to Lukashenko. I was reading this book not long after the massive protests started last year, and I'm curious if you feel like that meant anything at all within the Białowieża region, because there's this emphasis in certain parts of the book on tutejsi, right, the folks from here, which also is a very sort of long-term historical social category of significance, in the sense of not wanting to speak to broader trends, but being really embedded in complicating and problematizing and breaking norms in a way that shows a lot of the continuities that you were just talking about, whether left over from the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth or really showing that some of these constructions are artificial on the Polish-Belarusian border. I'm just curious, just stick with Leszek for a second. Could he have grown up in on the Belarusian side, or could he have functioned on the Belarusian side and been more or less the same? Or did he really have to be ultimately Polish?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I don't want to speak directly for the way people living in Białowieża today interpreted the events in Belarus, because I haven't been there in 3 years, so I don't want to get myself in trouble. But what was so surprising to me when I was there was how much people talked about what it meant to be Belarusian on the Polish side of the border, what that idea of Belarus meant, but then just an unknowing of what was happening in Belarus in many ways. Nobody ever talked about the Accords, which dissolved the Soviet Union, which took place in the Bielowieskaya Puszcza on the Belarusian side. So I think Leszek became Polish with this undergrounded Belarusian identity, an identity that was always present, always part of Tutajsze, but in so many ways was Polonized. And I don't want to see that Polonization as complete, or that there's ever some kind of pure ethnic identity, because this term Tutajsze means I am from here. But there was certainly in the interwar period, a time when Belarusians were associated with the Soviet Union. They couldn't get jobs in state forestry as school teachers. There were language schools that opened and then closed. And then the communist period, nobody's supposed to be talking about who's Belarusian, who's Polish. So this kind of suppression of ethnic identity that then finds some flourishing in the post-socialist period. But for people who have mixed ethnic heritage there, there's certainly an ideal that it's better, I think, to be Polish, and not, of course, amongst everyone. But we have to understand the way that dominant trend works in terms of when is it okay to speak po swojemu, our own language. Is that appropriate in shops where there's mixed identity? Is it only if you belong to the Orthodox Church? And then it would become interesting for me, who would sing songs that were associated with, being in this place forever? Who would say, oh, those songs are really Soviet songs? What sort of Polish songs would get sung? I mean, Leszek talked about himself a lot as being Polish. I mean, he was very clear about this Belarusian heritage, but it wasn't in a way that certain identity activists, Belarusian identity activists in cities were doing. People like Sokrat Janowicz from Krynki, people in Hajnówka or, other nearby towns that really wanted to visit Belarusian cultural centers and make sure that their kids went to a language school. I mean, Leszek didn't have any children who lived with him. The book sort of identifies that he has one child that's living far from him that he never really knew. So that's also not an issue for him reproducing ethnicity in that way. I can imagine also, when Poland became part of the EU, there used to be a lot of Belarusian traders that could be found in the town of Hajnówka. And then they suddenly also just disappeared. There's this new open border that's for tourists. So you mostly have Polish tourists going into Belarus. I saw very few Belarusian tourists coming into Poland. So that's also this soplicowo, or the ideal that what it means to be Polish could potentially mean to be multi-ethnic. But the ideal of being Polish is, on the one hand, is not just this right-wing version. It could mean a Mickiewicz idea that there are many languages and cultures tied into the Polish nation. And I want to keep that afloat, not as a way to colonize what it means to be Belarusian, but as a way of also showing people that national identity, or what it means to be a citizen of a certain nation, hasn't always meant the same thing historically. And I think that's important, not for a kind of chauvinism of what some sort of Polish greatness of the past was, but for a potential to provide more possibility within a nation that has a certain language that's primarily spoken today. And I think this is a really important moment to be highlighting a figure like Leszek, who did so much to sort of play in that world. I mean, in some ways, he's a victim of history, but he also has so much agency. And I always want to employ his ideas and his words to lead us in that direction. So I hope that's what I'm trying to do in that chapter, as well as one that comes later about playing with the idea of Belarusianness at the Polish-Belarusian border, on the Polish side of the border.
Yeah, I mean, the way you just explained, I think also casts him very powerfully as a figure for much broader forces, in the sense, you know, the word borderlands has become a real trope, and often a kind of a knee-jerk trope, I would say, in the past 20, 30 years across some of the disciplines in the humanities and social sciences. In this particular region, for me, one of the canonical works is Timothy Snyder's Reconstruction of Nations. And the way that you described this kind of non-monolithic sense of national attachment, right, where you don't have to choose, but that doesn't mean it doesn't matter, because there is a shared past and there are distinct identities, but there's also crossover. And if we start Xing parts of that matrix out, then we're Xing out parts of ourselves. For me, that really comes through in the figure of Leszek. So I definitely saw that in the book. I'm curious how outsiders fit in, though, because that's, of course, part of the borderlands problem, is that people are passing through, or they're popping in and popping out in the case of tourists. And there are two different kinds of castes there that strike me. One, I remember the way you described having dinner at former Prime Minister Cimoszewicz's cabin. And I was thinking to myself, when you were speaking earlier during the interview about the return of public figures to Białowieża, if you're a former prime minister, do you need to have a cabin in Białowieża? And what does that do for this sense of tutejszość and the tutejsi there?
Yeah, well, you know, Cimoszewicz identified as having Belarusian roots, so I think that's really significant. But yeah, tutejsze, you know, I don't know enough historically about who intermarried with who at some certain moment, but like everywhere, I'm sure that there were intermarriages across class, across ethnicity. I mean, we know a lot about Poles and Belarusians. I mean, I feel like the missing piece of my book is the Jewish past or the Jewish history in this region, which was really significant as a timber history. But yes, borderlands are places that get crossed and that have lots of mixture. So how does that play out in a moment, a political historical moment in which people want to believe in some kind of pure ideal of what it means to be Polish or Belarusian? And I saw that play on both sides, but they're not sides with equal amounts of power. So at that local regional, and sometimes, you know, there are people who are really confusing for me also about which side are you on in terms of your own ethnic identity. And I think this comes out in the book about the rise of ONR. And, you know, there are people with mixed ethnic identity who really want to look to the past and talk about the cursed soldiers and the way that they are heroic in some way, but people who really strongly identify as Belarusian or Tutaishe want to say, these cursed soldiers pacified whole Belarusian villages in this region. So yeah, I think the work of historians and anthropologists is to guide people into this past. And of course, we are never totally neutral, but if we're working only in the service of some kind of politics or nationalist ideal, I think we're really doing our craft in the wrong way.
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is
going to say, speaking to the realities of 2020 and 2021,
yeah.
All the colleagues I speak to from the region, but I mean, and in that, in some sense, that's, you know, why I'm so glad to see the book, but also that it touches on an angle that's less often considered for me. But I want to take you back to what you said about the missing piece, the Jewish story, because I was thinking about this also, and I'm glad you brought up Oner. There is a constructed Jewish other, obviously, in the rise of, whether it's local or imported from other parts of Poland, far-right activism, some of it connected to Prawo I Sprawiedliwość, some of it not. And it strikes me also, you know, after all, you mentioned the Uniwersytet Powszechny.
Yeah.
A lot. I know it was very important for you personally. Adam Wajrak obviously plays a big role in your book and more generally, I think, in your story with the region. I'm curious if there is a sense of, either in terms of what you saw in your field work or what you see sort of reflecting now that the book is done, where the legacy, the Jewish legacy, whether actual historical or purely constructed, and I know that actual historical also is a construction, obviously, so it's maybe a false dichotomy, but on the other hand, Oner activists who have absolutely no direct experience whatsoever of local Jewish population versus some idea that, oh, well, this aspect of Solidarność's legacy is bad because it's tainted somehow by cosmopolitanism, where cosmopolitanism has an anti-Semitic flavor to it, too. I'm just curious how you would make sense of that. I'm not asking you to write the missing Jewish part of the book back in, but if you look at it from the standpoint of the end of the book, of what's been going on in the past 5 to 10 years, is that really one of the dominant tropes in spite of what we've been discussing?
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, again and again and again, there were people opposed to nature conservation who had kind of political positions, who wanted to talk about a Jewish conspiracy on the part of nature activists or, you know, a kind of Warsaw elite that wanted to better preserve this place. So that's underlying. I think my own apprehension about really writing effectively was that I felt like I would need to be a historian or I would need to ask questions in a different way than I had been asking them. So I just sort of nod in a few short ways in the book to that tension and to the history behind ONR and Roman Dmowski and the kind of poisonous idealizations about which ethnicities or nations can be ingested into what it means to be a Pole and which need to be excised or cut out. I also want to nod to the important work of Katarzyna Winiarska, who was a teacher at the Uniwersytet Powszechny. And she's married into the Kuron family that I write about in the book. She is she doesn't have an advanced degree, but she has been doing all of this groundwork to find information about the Jewish past, to interview people in Israel, in the U.S., I mean, survivors of the Holocaust who came from Białowieża, who are now in their 80s or 90s. She's created an online museum of these resources. I always knew about a site where both Belarusians and perhaps Poles and Jews were executed. This is a kind of mass execution site during the Nazi occupation, German occupation. But there was no memorial there to Jews. It just said Poles and Belarusians died here. There was a big kind of metal eagle. It was a sand pit that was dug out. And I know that she's done work to memorialize that place, to add a Star of David, to bring people into dialogue about what that Jewish past has meant. So I wish I could, that might be, you know, a next project. But I wasn't able to do it with enough precision to do it well. And so I hope, although it may be possible that people really see that as a flaw of the book, and I just want to apologize for that, but also to stress my limitation of capacity in really accessing that story and doing it in an accurate way.
I think that would make a wonderful follow-up project. And I completely, not having worked directly there myself as a researcher, I can see the time and the depth in a slightly different direction that would be required. Are you thinking of doing that follow-up?
Well,
no commitment required.
It's not on the top of my list. I'm really interested in rewilding phenomenon, but yeah, maybe. My next novel is 3 years away, so we'll see.
I understand. We have about 10 more minutes, so there are maybe two or three other things that I want to touch on. I actually haven't talked much. Obviously, I'm a historian, so you can see my so-called déformation professionnelle. I keep dragging you back into history. But why don't we talk for a second, in more anthropological terms, how you feel that looking at a primeval forest and the way it's narrativized and the way that its historical narratives are constructed in light of contemporary politics, which especially is where your book ends, translates back and what kind of implications it has for thinking about the way you sort of position early in the book historical time on the one hand and deep time on the other. In other words, if I can put this a little bit naively, does it matter to the forest in deep time terms what the narratives are? This is an environmental historian's question too.
Yeah. Well, who can speak for the forest? I'm very influenced as an anthropologist by what's called the ontological turn. So this is the idea that anthropology moves from only studying humans to seeing the agency of non-humans. And here we have the forest. And of course, this forest has been in existence as a forest since the end of the Ice Age, you know, and it wasn't industrially logged until World War I. So the forest has a lot of memory. It has a lot of integrity. But I also think the forest is never inert backdrop. It is always acting on people too. I mean, it has agency. So the reason I kept going back to Bioviesia were these bark beetle outbreaks, and bark beetle is in the title of the book. What's that all about? Well, this is a native bark beetle that has been in existence as long as the forest has been in existence, but it only preys on spruce trees. And so it weakens the tree. You have outbreaks every few years, and some years they're worse than others. So it's especially troubling in an era of climate change, but troubling as the forest has been also co-created or co-constructed by foresters. And this argument always gets me into trouble with my nature conservationist friends who want to say, well, this is a primeval forest. Like, it was not constructed by humans. And I agree, you know, mostly, but I also want to show like, but it's only the type of forest it is because you had czars hunting there that brought in the type of deer that were exotic and that shot a certain number of bison every year. And that hired beekeepers to create some fires in the forest that hollowed out the trees. So, you know, environmental historians always want to show this dance between the human and the non-human. And you can't always get nature to do what you want it to do. So foresters have been trying to construct this forest. I mean, you could look at that very serious break as to when the forest is industrially logged, so start of World War One, but you could also go back a little further. I mean, there are certainly, there's some forestry, there's some potash production. You know, foresters are both watching the royal game and making sure there's enough, but doing some small moderations. But the whole history of the 20th century is about constructing a forest in the ideal of the forester's model. And then, you know, you could say, well, how successful was that, given that you still have these patches of old forest within what is state forestry lands? You have this huge, not huge, but large enough national park that things can move out of. You know, it's not just like in the national park, you have more oak and linden or old pine trees and more deadwood debris. I mean, there are animals that move between the state forest and the logged forest. So I think it's important to always know that the historical time is not just the moment at which the forest becomes managed. The historical time is the short time. We don't totally understand the deep time of this forest, but it's there. And I think there must be elements to this forest, which in some kind of DNA way, you know what's going on. The stuff that makes up the trees, that flows in the water, these are old materials and we don't fully understand them. So maybe I'm going back to Simona Kosak and her mystical visions of this place. But as an environmental historian, I want people to see that the forest is not just being acted upon in historical time. It is also doing acting. These bark beetle outbreaks cause a strong reaction by by foresters who want to then attack the bark beetle, by the nature activists who show up and have their own ideals about what it means to be cosmopolitan, international. There has to be this weaving of both in a narrative that comes out of this forest. And that's my commitment as an anthropologist of the non-human and the human, or more than human, as we like to say.
Well, that said, it strikes me that there's an engaged aspect really at the intersection of the two. And I mean, in that sense, I guess we have to come back to politics to end the conversation, because first of all, we're in the thick of it, so to speak. I think anyone who is watching Poland and Eastern Europe in October of 2021, but also the fact that deep time, for all of its mystique and all of its power and all of its agency, which we even can't even get to, has the potential to be ended by historical time in some sense. And I think of this, I'm a scholar in part of religion and of religious thought, and there's an apocalypticism that strikes me when I think about a primeval forest simply being logged, because contingent human agency in a very particular moment, or the narratives being constructed, can really be responsible for undoing something that so profoundly transcends our own individual or even collective human experience, right? Yeah. And in that sense, I'm of two minds about the story ending with law and justice, partly because on the one hand, law and justice really was logging and really was threatening the UNESCO designation and really was threatening everything you were just describing. But by the same token, they are a political party. So how do we escape being trapped in contemporary politics as a kind of payoff from this sort of powerful series of telescoped lenses that I see in your book?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to tell everybody, just go to this forest. don't read the book. Just be in the forest and see all of its complexity. But yes, I also hope that in the very, very last chapter, people get or they read that I'm fully committed to protection for this forest. And, you know, the model that we have, however imperfect it is the national park model right now for this whole forest. That, I mean, a forest ecosystem that has some integrity, as this one does, even though there are parts of it which seem so crippled by the extreme logging, by the unnecessary logging, I think this forest still has the potential to regrow, to regenerate, but that's not going to happen as long as humans are constantly there with a managerial agricultural model of growing trees, and growing trees is the most important. And I think one of the solutions that not enough people have looked towards, a solution for like for jobs of foresters, is there's all this agricultural land outside of the Biol Vieja forest. I mean, we could really think about expanding this zone. We could think about if we really need, there's lots of trees grown in Europe. I mean, lots of trees all over Poland, Sweden, elsewhere. But if you want to keep people working in state forestry there, I mean, one could purchase agricultural land and slowly grow this forest out and out and out, and then grow that, let's use the word pristine, you know, this kind of pristine national park area. Let that grow. Think of small nudges for like how to restore the hydrology of this area. I mean, the area had been so long drained. How do we think about getting water to stay in the landscape through having dead trees on the ground, through building more forest cover in areas that have been clear cut? I mean, all of those things need to be thought of and need some kind of human care and intervention. But I think unless we have a few places in the world that are that have really have a lot of biological integrity that are related to something that's very ancient, very old, very primeval, I think we're lost. We're lost spiritually. We're lost as cultures. I feel very committed to that. And I hope in some way that my book leads people there, even though I don't, you know, go off on the only story of this place is a story of this primeval nature. I want the story to be more than that.
I think that's a wonderful note on which to end. It's also, I think, a hopeful note, which I want to preserve. Let me thank you, Professor Blavaskunas, for speaking to our New Books in East European Studies audience. Again, the book is called Foresters, Borders, and Bark Beetles, The Future of Europe's Last Primeval Forest, and it came out in 2020 with Indiana University Press. Thanks very much. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you so much.